We're back with our guest, Richard Michelson, gallery owner, children's book author, and poet. You want to pick out another one to read for us? Or are we working our way up to something big now? Or
I don't know. Is there something that you are interested in?
Well, it seems while we have lots of time, and time seems extravagant when you're young like we are, I really do like this concluding poem recital. It seems to me it's got enormous scope and resonance and might actually really be a great poem. And I sort of, even though it's going to take maybe 10 minutes, I'd like to hear it.
All right, if everybody wants to get up, go to the bathroom,
pull over the side of the road.
That's right, stretch.
Mm-hmm. Whatever you need to do, get it done now.
All right. All right, hope you're back.
I think they are. I could hear them. Remember, too, that radio takes place in total darkness, so we're asking Richard to read a poem that he must have from memory, because you can't see in here, of course.
Recital. And this starts with an epigraph. Blessed is the Lord, who trains my hands for battle, my fingers for warfare. And that's Psalm 144, the original poem. My hands, French braiding my daughter's hair before her recital, are suddenly my grandmother's, kneading the ceremonial Friday night challah. The same dark veins, the Tigris, the Euphrates, spreading life into each tributary. Or, turned palms up, eight trains arriving at the same station at the same time, two others already emptied and heading back out, boxcars with pet names like the racing boats of the wealthy, interior affairs, foreign policy, or elbows held close to the body, 10 escape routes and 2 shtetls, my great-grandmother in one, my great-grandfather in the other. I'm holding them both in my hands. I'm like God in that old camp song when my daughter starts to play and I, forgetting myself, clap and keep clapping. And I think maybe this world is like God's boat and he calls it genocide. And the next world is also his and hours to share. 2, foreign policy. Recital is the name of the poem I was reading at my first recital. My voice strung tight as young David's slingshot, his first war stretched between his sinewy hands. This is the battle he would sing about years later. But first, he had to learn to play the lyre, practice poetry and song, love and prayer. So much work just to celebrate his victory. Imagine him at the slaughterhouse, choosing the sheep, cutting its guts, his grandmother working quickly beside him, keeping the casing fresh to ensure the sensuous quality of the sound. She separates the fat, rinses off the excrement, removing the membranes except for the muscle fiber, while David, his thick thumbs bleeding now, dries and braids the hanks. Music fit for a king. 3, genocide. Recital is the name of the poem I was reading at my first recital, when in the back, I heard somebody's grandmother shuffling down the hallway, her whole bridge game, Slavic barges, in tow. And suddenly, chairs were scraping all over the place. Speak up, she says. What are you saying? I'm reading the numbers on her forearm, each numeral a poem written by God. Perfect, meaningless, and containing all meaning, just as you'd expect in a poem by the poet laureate of all universes, of all religions, of all time. 4, interior affairs. My wife's already in the kitchen baking cookies for our daughter's first recital. When I sit down for breakfast, somewhere it's nighttime. Bombs are falling and children are starving. But I'm pouring the milk and the sugar, whistling a song and nibbling the nape of my lover's neck on my way back to the refrigerator. And neither of us can guess who will eventually find the cunning enemy, cancer, hiding like a secret code ring in the cereal box of the body. 5. Battles. All this, I'm remembering, was years ago. But years later, I'm rereading Recital to my daughter, who turned out to be a pianist after all, and is practicing for her own recital at the same North Shore Jewish nursing home. Her grandmother mired in the mud of the waiting list, and the whole family conspiring to maneuver her to the front of the line. She's the last soldier standing between me and my death. She's the pre-Columbus boat heading over the edge of the horizon, and I'm the nameless little boat following. Her husband died in the War of the Streets. And her brother died in the war to end all wars. And her father died in the war before that. And the personal war my wife and I have waged between us for so long that it's beginning to look like nostalgia only seems never ending. I want to die. Not like Saul on the battlefield of my own sword, nor like Solomon, my house in disarray, but like David in his bed, reciting the Psalms, at war only with his own soul. Lullabies. I'm standing in the back of the room listening to my daughter's recital, her fingers furiously pumping up and down, and now diminuendo towards the end, controlling the strings and valves of my heart. Maybe I am the sheep, sacrificing my inner life for the sake of her song. Or maybe her palms and fingers, resting face down on the keys, are only her palms and fingers resting. I'm alone in the back of the room, a sentry guarding the free cookies, which, according to policy, cannot be eaten except in the recreation hall we call the afterlife. Otherwise, no one would sit still for the music, half the audience deaf and the rest already sailing home on the faint breath of the small boats they've christened battles and lullabies. I want to die, not like Goliath, a victim of modern warfare, nor like Uriah turned love's collateral damage, but like David himself, a shepherd leading his flock to feed among the flowers. 7, the revision. Would you still love me, my daughter asks, if I had played all the wrong notes? She's wondering what it means to be her, Jewish, American, and upper middle class in a time of war, when all she really wants to think about is poetry and song. Would you still love me, my wife asks, if I were old, ugly, too thin, toothless? She's bombing her own body weekly, shrapnel embedded in the roof and walls of the holy house where we prayed and made love. Would you still love me, David asked his God, if I killed a man for no better reason than to take his beautiful wife as my lover? Would you still love me, I asked my father, if instead of fighting my own battles, I deserted, conscientiously objected, sat on the sidelines, writing, without even once harnessing the power to revise my life like words on a page? Would you still love me? God asked my grandmother in the reception hall before his grand recital. If I wiped out your entire family, let's say all at once, leaving only one self-involved American tributary to tell the tale. Life, my grandmother once explained to me, is not poetry, never was, and was never meant to be. Now, by way of answer, I watch her wipe away the faint smudge of chocolate still fresh on God's lips. Your grandmother's one tough cookie, he whispers to me, while she rustles about, her chair scraping every which way. What, she asks? Speak up, or no one will hear a word you are saying. As for your certain and coming death, she adds, I don't know if you're a religious man, but you might try praying. Thank you. It ends with a... I don't know what an epigraph is. I don't know what it is at the end. What is an epigraph at the end? At the end.
That's a really good question.
From Psalms 138, your steadfast love is eternal. Do not forsake the work of your hands.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure I've ever seen an epigraph at the end of a poem before. I think that's it's a brilliant idea. It is like a bow on the package because, of course, it's, again, from Psalms where you began.
Thank you, and thank the audience for patience. It's very difficult to sit for a long poem.
Well, who says they were sitting?
That's right.
We don't know what they were doing, whoever they are. Contrary to rumor, we don't know absolutely all of you out there, just a lot of you.
And the screen, actually, I'm looking at the wall behind me, there's like hundreds of little TV sets with each showing every listener.
Right.
As they're at the radio, and a couple of people I noticed kind of zoned out during that. We'll talk to them later.
Yeah, we'll talk to you. Know who you are. The poem, the first section is called The Original Poem, and then later on there's a section called, the final one is The Revision. So in one sense, the poem is reflecting on itself. It is conscious of itself as a series of revisions. And then at the end, in that extraordinary stanza that begins, life, my grandmother once explained to me, is not poetry, never was, and was never meant to be. And earlier on, you said, you know, if we can revise these poems, you know, how can we do that without even once harnessing the power to revise my life like words on the page? So the reflective quality, the self-reflective quality that the poem has is not implosive. I mean, it really involves thinking about poetry, and it involves thinking about revisions and revisions of self and powerful subjects. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult subject. It's a difficult... let's talk about political poetry. I'm very torn. There's wars going on. Most people are suffering. And I'm sitting very comfortable in my study, running up to the refrigerator whenever I need, writing about the other people's difficulties. Maybe instead of getting my butt up and... going and doing something real in the world, so you know it's that's really the part about sitting on the sidelines writing while other people are suffering, and what do you do about that? Is a difficult difficult question.
Yeah, I mean it is
as an artist.
Yeah, it is, but of course there are moments when. You mentioned things like artworks created in concentration camps and the fact that no matter what happens, no matter what kinds of wars are going on, somehow the arts continue to run their parallel course to the course the world runs.
Could you imagine that? I mean, to me, that's incredible. People at the risk of their lives creating art, the pull that must be is just inconceivable to me.
Yeah, it seems And it's not, I don't think you can dismiss its motivation as purely one of consolation or distraction or escapism. I think it's another frequency that people keep open as long as they can, no matter what else is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think consequently, when you no more would want that frequency to go off the air than any of the other frequencies of so-called real life,
mm-hmm.
you know, in order to fall into the dialectic of the grandmother in the closing section there.
Mm-hmm. This is how this poem began, I'll tell you, only because it has very little to do with the poem, so you can see how far afield we go from original impulses. But my daughter, when she was young, was playing the piano. She is grown up and is a composer now.
Hmm.
And in fact, we used to, as a social good, drag her around to old age homes so that she could play for the people. So that she would learn to grow up to be a good person.
Yeah, I did that when I was a kid, too.
Right.
Look what happened. It didn't work in my case.
It doesn't always work.
No.
And my wife, who's even more wonderful, would bake these lovely chocolate chip cookies to give out after the recital. And I showed up late, as I often do to these things, unlike Roger, who ran off to see the baseball game. I'm always
That's 'cause
divided.
It was baseball and not
That's
art.
Right. So I came late to see my daughter, young, playing her heart out, and a whole room of people listening to her on the piano, and, you know, it just did my heart good, and I was standing in the background, and all of a sudden, I heard a walker coming down the hall, and some fella in a very loud voice said, "What's going on in there?" And an even louder voice, somebody answered, "They're giving out free chocolate chip cookies, but they make you listen to the music first."
So that's why the narrator appears as a sentinel watching the cookies
that's
in the back
right.
of the room.
My poor baby.
Yeah, that's terrible. Yeah.
Heart broke.
Yeah. Well, it seems not to have derailed her performance. And, of course, recital has a couple meanings. It's the recital of the, because the poem is self-reflexive, it's the recital of the poem itself, which you just did. And it's also the recital in the sense of a musical performance that a student makes in order to demonstrate the progress of her skills.
Right. And the poem is structured as well, I'm trying, as a musical piece might be.
Yeah, it has themes that return, as themes would return in a concerto, say. Things that keep coming back. It seems as if... another thing that runs through it is because of that series of rhetorical questions, "Would you still love me?" my daughter asked if I had played all the wrong notes, and then comes a bunch of other questions saying, "Is love somehow autonomous and not reliant upon behavior? You know, can we think things and do things that would run counter to somebody else's love and still retain that love?" And you know, they seem like rhetorical questions. They go by, and each one has a sort of philosophical touch to it. So there's a kind of Talmudic accumulation. Mm-hmm. You're piling one question upon the other. But then the question finally becomes, what is the durability of love, and how can it last? And then when you look back across the poem, you see that it's really about the wrong notes, if the hypothetical wrong notes and other misdeeds that we might make. But also, I think it's an affirmation of that can continue and can continue not only through our private vicissitudes, but through all the nasty little things that the world does.
Could you write that down for me? I like that.
Sure.
Exactly what I was trying to. Thank you very much. I think.
Mm. Oh, your taxes are already paying for me to spew all of this stuff all day
all right.
long. So just consider it a minor tax refund. Yeah, and that, I think, There's something about that poem with the fact that you mentioned the names of fancy ships, yachts at the beginning, foreign policy, and the other name, and they come back as sections. So there's an echo there. There's a section called a genocide, and previously you've got the world. God calls the world genocide, and so of course it is, and all those meditations about. How you would like to die, you know, how, since you have to participate in this world called genocide, you're trying to go through a recital, in effect. You know, here's the way, here's what I don't want to do, here's what I don't want to do, here's how I would do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big question for me, and certainly I think I'm not alone in that, I hope I'm not, is, you know, how we conduct ourselves in this world, how we live and try to enjoy ourselves amidst various griefs, and yet still celebrate, and that's the heart of it, I think.
Yeah, and again, this fits squarely with the theme that you were talking about earlier. You know, the question of wars and the question of how we go on being comfortable and how we can bear being comfortable and when things are as they are. So, yeah, I mean, it's that's one thing I really like about this book is that it can run all these registers at the same time. And when I said earlier that the Holocaust is like a ghost, a smoky gray ghost that's in the corners of it, that's not all that there is. I mean, there's all kinds of light refracted through that smoky, hazy ghost, and sometimes it's art, and sometimes it's love, and sometimes it's take out the garbage. You know, it's really wonderful in that.
Right. Much appreciated.